Used to be said in our meeting, if friends' minds are easy, we shall begin business immediately. Well, the subject for today is the one that I was unable to speak about last time, but I thought I'd better deal with it nevertheless, and that is Quakerism and theology. There are some people that don't like even the word theology, let alone the subject, but there does seem to be quite a revival of interest in theology, so that even the New Yorker, and I've heard that even Playboy has articles on theology. Seems rather incredible. But there were very long articles in the New Yorker that took hours to read not long ago on some of the modern theologians. And they seem to be listened to today much more than the modern philosophers, because the theologians do attempt to have answers to the ultimate problems about the meaning of life and the goal of life, and the philosophers are rather given that up. Of course, philosophy and theology overlap a good deal. I might begin with a few generalities and then get down to particulars. I'm not sure whether this board's visible or not. Is it? I won't use it very much. Might be slightly visible. We might divide the various theological systems in this way. If we represent this as God, and this as the world, not quite as round as it was in the Aronoff's pictures, and that separation of God and the world is called deism. Deism believes that God made the world, and then he went away and left it and let it run along like a machine. He sort of wound it up like a watch, and now the world goes along without miracles, without the intervention of providence, without the interference of God. And deism was the popular religion of the founding fathers, like Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, and so on, that whole group. And about the beginning of the 18th and the latter part of the 19th and latter part of the 18th century, deism was the popular religion because it agreed with science. You see, God didn't interfere with the laws of science. He let science operate. Now, this kind is more general, where God, that's God, and this is the world. God interferes in the world. He performs miracles. He performs acts of providence. He intercedes in answer to prayer, and so on. So God and the world overlap according to God's will, to the extent that he wishes. Sometimes you hear his voice, and sometimes you don't, according to his decision. So a prophet might hear the voice of God, or he might not, according to whether God chose to interfere in the world. Now, another kind of religion which has come into popularity very recently is the case where, well, this kind you're all familiar with, where God and the world are identical. That's called pantheism, of course. This is called theism. The second one is theism. The third one is pantheism, where God and the world are identical, and God is equally present in all things that he created. He's in everything. And when you look at nature, you look at God, and so forth. That is not an unusual religion. I've often heard it expressed in friends' meetings and in some form or other, that everything is full of God, and God is represented by everything that exists. I haven't got room for them all here. Now this if you say this is God and this is the world is in God, but God is also transcendent. He's both immanent in the world, present to everything in the world, but he's beyond the world. He's beckoning to the world to go forward to some other place where it is now. He's exerting a pressure or influence on the world to transform it and change it. I've just been listening to Marion Glazer's recording of the latest important theological work, Exploring into God, by Bishop Robinson, who wrote that famous book, Honest to God, and originating the phrase, God is dead. Now, the God who died was the transcendent God, the God who is outside the world, or this God who is transcendent. But Bishop Robinson, who would be considered, I think, the most modern of all modernists, is a panentheist. Pan, P-A-N, all, and, yen, theist. Panentheist would be all in God, but God transcends. I think that would be the religion or theology of Alfred North Whitehead, who has a good many followers in this country. That God is beyond the world, exerting a pull on it from outside, but he's also in it. He's immanent and transcendent both. And then you can, of course, have the only other possibility, I won't try to make this one very good, is for God and the world, God to be in the world, but not in control of all of it. That's what we call a finite deity. God is finite because he doesn't have control of all the world. He has only the control of the good part of the world is God, but the bad part is outside of him. So he isn't responsible for any of the evil that occurs in the world. But he's waging a battle with the devil or whatever it is that's outside of him. He's waging a battle with the rest of the world for its control. And he may win, or he may not. That's William James's idea. H.G. Wells wrote a book called The Finite God, which had a good deal of influence. And the idea that God is a power in the world working toward good, but has not yet won a victory. That would be something like the Zoroastrian religion, where God and the devil are both great powers fighting with each other. Although in Zoroastrianism, God is sure to win the victory in the end. Well, that's just a little theological lesson on a variety of theological opinion. I think all theologies could be grouped under that particular head. Now, there's another distinction which I think is important, because a good deal of the confusion in Christian theology, and I think there is a great deal and always has been, is that Christian theology has two ancestors that are quite different. It's not unusual to have two ancestors, of course, but then if the two ancestors differ from each other, it might make some difficulty. Well, the two ancestors are, of course, the Greek, the Hellenic, and the Hebraic. Our Bible was written by Hebrews. I think every bit of it was written by a Hebrew. But there are very important Greek influences in it, because Palestine was under Greek domination for a good many years, and the Jews of Palestine, especially the Jews in the diaspora who were scattered out over the world, those Jews came very much under the influence of Greek philosophy, and some of them contributed to the Bible. Now, Hebrew is, what'll I say, it's Hebrew is ethical and puts a good deal of emphasis on activity, and the Greek is metaphysical. I haven't written that very well, but you can understand it maybe. Metaphysical and ethical. Or you might say the Hebrew is active, believes in activity, and the Greek is contemplative. That is, if you want to find reality, you do it through contemplation of the absolute being. Whereas with the Hebrew, you're more likely to reach the goal through some kind of activity. For the Hebrew, God is a person, or personality is the ultimate, personality is the ultimate thing in the universe. There's nothing higher in the universe than personality. So God must be a person. Whereas in the Greek idea, God is being or reality. I'll write it being or reality. The absolute reality at the basis of all existence. Tillich, the most important modern theologian, would say that God is being, which underlies and undergirds all other existence. Well, I could give a lot of other. Now, in the Hebrew thought, a thing like the incarnation, God becoming man, would be a paradoxical miracle. How could God become man? So the incarnation, I won't write this down, the incarnation would be a miracle here. But here it would not be a miracle, it would be almost inevitable, because every human being is to some extent an incarnation of God. And Jesus would be simply more of an incarnation than I am or you are. The only difference between me and Jesus would be a matter of degree in the Greek philosophy, whereas in the Hebrew it's a paradoxical miracle that God became man and cannot be explained on any basis of reason. And the same way with inspiration. In the Hebrew thought, inspiration is only occasional. God speaks when he chooses to. Sometimes he speaks and sometimes he doesn't. And it's purely arbitrary whether he speaks or not. It's his choice. Whereas in the Greek, God is always present at the basis of your being. God is always in you and never away from you, because he's the very essence of your soul, the very heart of your existence. So God is always there. And if you don't hear him speak, it's your fault and not his. It's because you haven't penetrated down to the roots of your being where God is. So God is at the center of your being, and you reach him by penetrating to him through the various layers of your own discordant self. Whereas here, God may speak or may not, as he chooses. Well, there are other differences that I could point out, but you can see that those are radically different ways of looking at the world. The Greek and the Hebrew, it's rather astonishing that during the Middle Ages there was so much persecution of the Jews, because they were accused of putting Christ to death, which is not true. It was the Romans who put Christ to death. The Jews had no right to take life. The Romans reserved that for themselves, and they were 100% responsible. But the Bible was written in such a way as to give the Romans as favorable a look as possible, because the Christians were being persecuted by the Romans. And they didn't want to anger their persecutors by making them look like murderers. But I don't think we often realize that we do owe our religion to the Jews. We owe our science and our philosophy to the Greeks. At least they began it, and it was carried on later, much later, usually, by others. I remember hearing of a dialogue between a Jew and a Catholic. The Jew asked the Catholic, "What are you going to do when you grow up?" He says, "I'm going to be a priest." And the Jew said, "Fine, and what then?" "Well, maybe I'll become a bishop." "Fine, and what then?" "Well, I might become a cardinal." "Fine," said the Jew, "and what then?" "Well," said the other, "I don't know, I might even become a pope." And the Jew said, "Fine, and what then?" And the Catholic got indignant, and he said, "What are you saying? You don't expect me to be Jesus Christ, do you?" And the Jew said, "Well, one of our boys made it." Which, of course, is true.